From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ahmed Khan Rahami is in custody. He's the man whom police say is connected to Saturday's bombings in New York City and New Jersey. The 28-year-old was wounded in a gunfight with police in Linden, New Jersey this morning. And joining us now with more is NPR's Hansi Lo Wong. Hi there, Hansi.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us, what more do we know about Rahami?
Well, we know that he received gunshot wounds during a shootout with police in Linden, New Jersey, and that's about a half hour west of New York City, and also a few minutes away from his last known address in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Like you said, he's 28 years old, U.S. citizen, born in Afghanistan. And we also know that through reporting by my colleague, Joe Shapiro of NPR's Investigations Unit, that there was a lawsuit filed by his family against the city of Elizabeth, New Jersey, accusing them of harassment that targeted their family business, a restaurant called First American Fried Chicken. And that was, they said there was treatment inspired by the plaintiffs, their religion and national origin and race. We're not sure exactly if that's motivation, but that's another piece in this puzzle.
And when was that lawsuit filed?
This was filed in 2011.
Okay. So how did law enforcement officials track Rahami down this morning?
Well, there was been an extensive manhunt starting on Sunday, and ultimately it ended when the police received a tip, and there was a man apparently sleeping outside of a bar in a hallway outside, and that man turned out to be Rahami. And so police encountered him, and eventually there was a shootout, and he was arrested after he received some gunshot wounds.
Now, I'm seeing reports that he was wounded, as you said, because he received some gunshot wounds. Do we know if any law enforcement officials were wounded in the exchange?
There are reports that law enforcement were also injured. Exactly what happened, we're not sure. We're trying to confirm those details.
Okay. So the bombs in Manhattan, in New York City and New Jersey, were of different kinds. Do we know anything more about that?
Well, we know that the ones in New York, the first one that went off, the one that actually went off in Chelsea in the Manhattan neighborhood, police are trying to still figure out, piece together exactly what it was because it ended up in pieces. But we know that there was a bomb that was found four blocks north of that, also in Chelsea, in the Chelsea neighborhood. That was a pressure cooker wrapped in duct tape and wire. One of my NPR colleagues actually saw it as she was walking and before police came and took it away, and that did not explode. And so the bombs that were found in New Jersey, and there have been multiple ones found, let's start with the one on Saturday morning before the Chelsea explosion. That was a pipe bomb-style bomb that exploded in a garbage pail, and that was very different than from the pressure cooker bombs in New York. And we're still figuring out exactly what type of bombs were found in Elizabeth, New Jersey early this morning.
And again, as you mentioned, Rahami is reported to have been living with his family in Elizabeth. Is that right?
That's his last known address. I'm not sure exactly what his living situation is at this point.
Okay. So what's the mood overall right now in New York and New Jersey?
Well, people came in to started their week off on a regular Monday morning, but with lots of subway delays and traffic delays, especially in Manhattan. And certainly the folks who live in Chelsea, in that neighborhood, there are still blockades on a number of the streets, including where the explosion occurred. And so people are trying to figure out how to kind of work around that. And it's a big question now of how the extent of this plot, it seems, and what exactly is the role of Rahami. We're still not sure. Police are taking him into custody for questioning. They have not named him as a suspect. And so it's unclear exactly, is this all over? And where do we go from here?
Not named him as a suspect, but again, as you've told us, there was an exchange of gunfire surrounding his arrest this morning. That's Hansi Lo Wong, national reporter for NPR, bringing us up to speed on the arrest of Ahmed Khan Rahami in New Jersey this morning. Hansi, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, both presidential candidates weighed in on the attacks and attempted attacks today. Donald Trump calling into Fox and Friends this morning.
We're allowing these people to come in. We don't want to do any profiling. If somebody looks like he's got a massive bomb on his back, we won't go up to that person and say, I'm sorry, because if he looks like he comes from that part of the world, we're not allowed to profile. Give me a break.
Hillary Clinton gave a short news conference in White Plains, New York, this morning as well. Here she is referencing Trump.
We know that A lot of the rhetoric we've heard from Donald Trump has been seized on by terrorists, in particular ISIS, because they are looking to make this into a war against Islam.
Joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, how does this impact the presidential race and given the statements that we just heard from both candidates there?
At this point, we know it's going to frame the conversation leading up to that first debate, which is just a week away. And it's going to focus attention, again, on the threat of terrorism and the issue of immigrants from the Middle East. And we do know that a little less than a year ago, when we had the horrendous shooting in San Bernardino, that was a boost to Donald Trump. It was really the moment when he kind of broke out of the Republican pack. But we did not see a corresponding bump for Donald Trump in June with the Orlando shooting. So we will see how this particular incident plays out.
And it seems like this issue is coming up again and again, where Donald Trump comes out and says something. In this case, he said the other day that he thought it was a bomb in New York before that had been kind of released by authorities. And Hillary Clinton comes out and says, we should wait until we have the facts to say, what is going on in a situation like this. Does that sway voters one way or the other, those arguments?
There has been a real divide between the reaction to Donald Trump on the part of, if you will, elite Republican policymakers, such as people who served in the George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush administrations, Richard Nixon's, Ronald Reagan's administrations, a number of whom have really denounced Donald Trump. And then there is quite a divide, though, when you start talking to rank-and-file Republicans, conservatives, independents generally, who find Donald Trump's line on many of these things to be quite resonant.
Let's listen to President Obama here, who spoke today in New York.
You know, at moments like this, I think it's important to remember what terrorists and violent extremists are trying to do. They are trying to hurt innocent people, but they also want to inspire fear in all of us.
What else did he say, Ron?
The president praised the law enforcement people in New York, also the FBI, the people who have been providing federal support in both New York and New Jersey. And he wanted to make a point to praise the resilience and the toughness of Americans in general, but particularly those in New York and New Jersey, whom he said he was quite confident would be able to bounce back.
On the politics, Ron, I want to go to another issue that has been talked about a lot over the last few days, and that's the birther issue after Donald Trump finally admitted on Friday that President Obama was born in the United States. Then all of his surrogates were asked over the weekend on the Sunday political shows about this. And here is Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, on CNN after Jake Tapper asked him why Trump kept the conspiracy theory alive for so many years.
It's just not true that he kept it up for 5 years. It's just
sure
simply not true.
It is true.
It wasn't like he was talking. No, Jake, it wasn't like he was talking about it on a regular basis until then. And when the issue was raised, he made very clear the other day what his position is.
Now, the Washington Post fact checker gave that claim four Pinocchios for being untrue. Ron, is the Trump campaign going to be able to put this issue aside as they clearly would like to do? Or is this going to come up again before November?
The Democrats are going to try to keep it in front of people for the remaining 7 weeks because they see this as perhaps the last passage beyond the pale for Donald Trump and his surrogates in terms of representing things that really happened quite recently and were in our memories, including Thursday night when Donald Trump refused to say whether or not he thought the president was born in the United States. That was Thursday night last week. And then, of course, the next morning he had an overnight conversion and blamed the whole thing on Hillary Clinton.
And in the same interview, by the way, that we just heard a little bit of, Chris Christie said that a Clinton campaign official had injected the birther issue into her 2008 campaign. Trump, even in that short statement he made on Friday, trying to blame Hillary Clinton for starting the birther controversy. What's true there?
Well, this is perhaps the most plowed furrow in the entire farm of fact-checking in American politics. Among other people, John Avlin of the Daily Beast is the editor-in-chief, has written a whole book called Wingnuts about conspiracy theories and the extremities of American politics. And where this traces back to is not Hillary Clinton and not a Clinton campaign official, but to a woman who was a Clinton supporter in Texas and very frustrated when her candidate conceded the nomination to Barack Obama in 2008. and started a story based on nothing but her speculation that Barack Obama might have actually been born somewhere else, like in Africa. And that caught on with a certain number of people who did not like Barack Obama in that summer. And then later on, even after Barack Obama was president, then it was picked up by a whole new group of people who made a major birther conspiracy out of it and really drove it for years. But by far and away, their best known proponent, the person who transitioned from being a reality TV star to being a politician on the issue, was Donald J. Trump.
That's NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
On Saturday, the new National Museum of African American History and Culture opens its doors in Washington. The museum will tell stories that are magnificent, awful, and profound. That's according to Robert Wilkins. He's a federal judge and chairman of the site committee of the presidential commission that led to the museum's authorization 13 years ago, back in 2003. But Wilkins says the museum's journey is much longer than that, and it dates back 100 years. He tells that story in his new book, and Judge Wilkins joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the title of your book is Long Road to Hard Truth, the 100-year mission to create the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Take us back to 1916. Why does the story begin there?
The story begins there because the year before the 50th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, there was a reenactment of the victory parade for Union soldiers. There had been the original victory parade in 1865. And 200,000 soldiers marched from the Capitol past the White House over the course of 2 days, and not a single one of them was an African-American combat soldier. Huh. 50 years later, in this reenactment by the Union veterans, lots of African-Americans came to Washington so that they could participate, but the event was segregated, as everything was during that time. And a group of prominent black Washingtonians put together a colored citizens committee so that this group of black veterans would have entertainment and transportation and places to stay while they were in Washington. And then afterwards they said, you know, we need a permanent memorial to honor African American soldiers. And then it grew to recognizing that there should be a memorial to all African American achievement, a museum.
And what was the initial reaction to the idea? Did it have support elsewhere in Washington?
There was broad support for it in the African American community in Washington and around the country. The other part of the context that's important here is that the movie Birth of a Nation had been released in 1915, and it had been screened at the White House. It was going around the country, and indeed, one of the very first rallies that this organization had that was created to build this memorial to Negro achievement, they called it, the flyer had emblazoned across the top in all capital letters, Birth of a Race. Uh-huh. And it's clear that they were responding affirmatively to declare that they were people and they were people who deserved recognition and respect.
I see. At what point in time did the idea for this museum gain support in the White House? If I remember correctly, President Calvin Coolidge at one time approved of the idea.
On his very last day in office, March the 4th of 1929, he signed the legislation into law that would create a commission to plan and build this national memorial building to Negro achievement. The problem is that the only way that they could get it passed over the opposition of the Southern Democratic congressmen was to take all the funding out of it. So it passed without any federal funding. They could get $50,000 in federal funding, but only if they raised $500,000 first. So President Hoover then takes over, and the timing couldn't be worse because in October of 1929, we have the stock market crash and the beginning of the Great Depression, and the effort essentially dies off.
And then how long does the idea remain dormant for?
It remains dormant until the mid-1960s, concurrent with the black arts and the black studies movements that are beginning in the mid-1960s. There was a great debate in Congress about whether it should be called a Negro Museum or an Afro-American Museum or African-American or black history, similar to the debate going on in America at that time. And James Baldwin and Jackie Robinson and Roy Ennis, they all testified in Congress in support of this, but nothing passed.
Nothing passed. So I'm just wondering, I want to talk for in a minute about sort of the where we find ourselves today. But in the course of your writing, Long Road to Hard Truth, I mean, what were some of the things, some of the reactions you had to this 100-year-long history and the fact that it did take so long and that the idea, it was a century ago that this very worthy idea first happened, but as we've been discussing, it's just sort of ebbed and flowed in terms of the nation's willingness to make it a reality.
You know, I have been frustrated and angry and had a range of emotions over the past 20 years that I've worked on this project. And that's the reason why I chose the title, Long Road to Hard Truth, because James Baldwin testified at that 1968 hearing, "My history tells the truth about America. It's going to be hard to teach it." It's very hard to celebrate African-American achievement or recognize talent within the African-American community if you're subjugating that community, which is what was happening in 1916. And it's also hard to talk about slavery and segregation and lynching when we all want to think of this as a great nation and the founding fathers as great leaders and great thinkers, but yet the ideals that were espoused in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution were far from being fulfilled for all Americans. And so I think it took a lot of political will and courage and vision for the leaders in Congress and President Bush to come together to do this. And I think that they're to be commended for it.
So the museum, of course, is opening now at a time where issues of racial injustice are no less present in America than they've ever been. I mean, we've got the Black Lives Matter movement, just one example. I mean, what role do you think the museum can play or should play in our current conversation and our current challenges about race and racial injustice?
Now, don't get me wrong. The museum isn't a panacea. No one institution, just like no one person, can solve, you know, an important problem facing the country, and certainly not the race issue or race problem in America. But having said that, I think that the museum can help all of us understand better the complicated history, the alliances that have been formed, the progress that we've made, all of the different nonviolent methods used to overcome that history. I think anytime people become more educated about an issue, they have a better ability to discuss it and to forge solutions and understanding.
Can you tell me of your experience, your personal experience as a black man in America? I mean, because I've seen you in other interviews talk very frankly about, you know, challenges even that you faced, you know, getting pulled over. And I don't know if you could tell me a little bit about that, because I'd love to understand more about how you're, you know, you approach this moment from the perspective of your own life.
Well, I mean, some of my experiences really propelled me to get involved in the movement to try to create this museum. In 1992, I was with family members when we were stopped by the Maryland State Police on the highway as we were returning from my grandfather's funeral in Chicago and driving back to Washington, D.C. And they got us out of the car and told us that unless we agreed to let them search the car, they would make us wait there for a drug-sniffing dog to be brought to the scene. And there was no reason for them to think that we had drugs. And I explained to them that I was an attorney and that there was a 1985 U.S. Supreme Court case called United States versus Sharp that they were violating, but my Harvard law degree and citation to authority didn't really do much good for me there on the side of the road. So ultimately, after a lengthy detention, we were let go. But it was very disheartening, and we sued and reached a settlement with the Maryland State Police. And part of the settlement was that they would agree to record their searches and what they found, if anything, and the race of the people that they were searching. And it showed that they were searching four black motorists for every one white motorist. And it led to, you know, even more litigation and a second settlement. And the case went on for 15 years. But in the midst of all of that, you know, I really felt like I wanted to be a part of something positive, of something that would hopefully help educate people about these issues, that would help bring the country together. And that's what really helped to drive me to work on this museum. And then also my experience as a public defender representing mainly African-American people in court, and just feeling like, you know, I was banging my head against the wall every day with these issues, and I wanted to be a part of something positive.
Well, Judge Robert Wilkins' new book is Long Road to Hard Truth, the 100-year mission to create the National Museum of African-American History and Culture. Judge Wilkins, thank you so very much for coming in today and for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Let's get back to our top story. 28-year-old Ahmad Khan Rahami is now in custody. He was arrested earlier today in Linden, New Jersey, in connection with Saturday's bombings in Manhattan and Seaside Park, New Jersey, and the bombs found and detonated by law enforcement robots in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Two law enforcement officials told NPR's Dina Temple-Raston that a cell phone attached to an explosive device initially led authorities to Rahami's father. In all cases, the bombs are believed to have been made of simple home devices, pipe bombs in both New Jersey cases and pressure cooker bombs in New York. Dan Linsky is managing director of the investigations firm Kroll. He's also the former superintendent in chief of the Boston Police Department, where he served during the Boston Marathon bombings in 2013. Dan, let's start with the Manhattan bombs. They're said to be made with pressure cookers, flip phones, and Christmas lights. What are the similarities to that and the Boston Marathon bombs?
It appears both the devices in New York are similar to the devices in Boston. Pressure cooker with gunpowder inside, Christmas lights for an activation network. We had a remote-controlled car that was our remote activation unit, and it appears they were scheduled to be activated by cell phones. That comes right out of Al-Qaeda's Inspire magazine on how to make these devices. And I'm assuming that there was shrap metal, ball bearings and nails, another piece of metal inside, similar to the devices we had, because that's the way Al-Qaeda encourages their followers to build these things.
And how easy is it for people to build a bomb like that?
We had two kids on welfare in Massachusetts that built several devices that shut down a city. It's very easy to get every one of those components from a local hardware store, fireworks. You know, you can put that stuff together in an afternoon shopping trip.
And what's the difference between a bomb like that and the pipe bomb that went off in New Jersey?
The pipe bomb is not as high pressure. It's not able to hold and contain the explosion for as long a period of time. Still a deadly weapon that can rip people to shreds and can cause death and injury. But a pressure cooker is a much more effective weapon to try and maximize casualties. The way in which device utilizes it, the pressure that's built up inside, creates a larger explosion that expands the shrap metal in a greater distance and at a greater speed.
Is this the most sophisticated bomb that a terrorist acting on his or her own could put together in this country?
Well, you know, we looked at what McVeigh did with some fertilizer and some diesel fuel. So, you know, there can be bigger bombs. And fortunately, I think we've got some tripwires in place that we're watching those types of purchases. There's TATP bombs that can very easily be made from household chemicals. So this is one of, unfortunately, a number of devices that can be made by people with information they can get freely over the Internet and that are being inspired to do just that from these terrorist groups that are out to get us.
Is there any way that manufacturers of pressure cookers could make them in such a way that they couldn't be used as a bomb?
I don't know. You know, many people use these things in their daily life, and it's not a problem or a challenge. But much like some of the chemicals and fertilizer, perhaps there's a tracking program that needs to go on these things. But, you know, if it's not a pressure cooker, they'll find something else.
That's Dan Linsky, who is managing director of the investigations firm Kroll. He was the superintendent and chief of the Boston Police Department during the Marathon bombings, where they used bombs very similar to the one that went off in New York. Dan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
There have been a number of major hacks recently of private information, including Colin Powell's private emails, Democratic National Committee documents, and Olympic athletes' medical records. Many of those breaches are known, or at least believed to have been perpetrated by Russian hackers. But those hacks could look like child's play if hackers succeed at perpetrating a larger-scale attack, one that takes down the entire internet. Bruce Schneier is a security technologist and a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He also writes the popular blog Schneier on Security. And he says that right now, someone is trying to learn how to do that, how to take down the internet. Bruce, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so in your post, it's titled, Someone is Learning to Take Down the Internet. Now, what do you mean by take down the internet?
Well, make it not work. There's a type of attack called a denial of service attack, mm-hmm. where basically an attacker goes to a site and bombards it with so much traffic that legitimate users can't get there and in a sense takes the site offline. This has been done for years. It's not new. There are lots of companies that work on defensive techniques. It's done for political reasons. It's done for fun. It's done for extortion. There's someone on the internet right now learning how to do that at scale. To internet backbone companies. And
okay, stop, pause right there for a second. Internet backbone companies,
yeah.
Meaning who?
Meaning companies that run the internet. So you might think of large service providers, telcos, name service providers, companies that provide the infrastructure that makes the network, that if a commercial site goes down, you can't get there. If one of these sites go down, you can't get to a lot of places.
Well, because like in your post, you write about one of them, VeriSign, which is the registrar for top-level domain names, the .coms, .nets.
Right. So VeriSign is one of those companies that if they disappear, you won't be able to get to most websites, .coms, .nets. You won't be able to send or receive most emails. A lot of things don't happen. Now, these denial of service attacks aren't permanent. They last for an hour, for a day, long ones maybe a couple of days. So this isn't shut down the internet forever. It's just for a short time. So what I found, and this is talking to people who are remaining anonymous, unfortunately, that there is someone who is trying to figure out how to do this at scale.
Mm-hmm.
They're launching these attacks not to take down the sites, but to figure out what it would take to take them down. They're launching sophisticated probing attacks for doing denial of service. And I mean, there's a lot of techie details here. The way to think of it is during the Cold War, the U.S. used to fly planes over the Soviet Union, very high altitudes. And the idea was not to bomb the Soviet Union, but to check on their air defense systems, to see when they would turn on, how they would react, what their blind spots, how they worked, that if someday there were war and we wanted to fly planes over the Soviet Union, we would know how.
Well, occasionally some of those planes did crash.
Occasionally there were problems, yes. But that kind of thing is what this very much looks like.
Okay, so
someone is figuring out how, in the event of them needing to be able to do this.
I want to talk with you more about the implications in just a second, but how did you discover that this was happening? How do the companies themselves know that this is happening, these probes?
So companies pay attention to denial of service attacks all the time. And these are not just probes. These are attacks at different levels, with different techniques. And all of these companies have sophisticated mitigation techniques. They know how to solve it. Nothing went down during these tests, but they see them happening. And over the past year and a half or so, this certain kind of attack has been happening that looks very much like these probes. And I found out because I'm a name in the industry. People talk to me and someone told me, look what I'm seeing, and showed me the data. I contacted other people at other companies who I know and said, I'm seeing this. Are you seeing this? I had two companies corroborate, again anonymously. I found the VeriSign report, which is public. If you go to my blog post on this, you can read the VeriSign report, which doesn't go into the level of detail, but does talk about these same sorts of attacks.
Right.
Pretty much everyone I spoke to said this is probably coming from China. Now, to be fair, that isn't definitive proof is hard here, but it is strong evidence. This doesn't feel like a hacker. This doesn't feel like a criminal. This looks like a nation state, like a cyber command, like a cyber military, just learning how to do offensive techniques should the need arise.
Mm. Now, you said it looks like China. Could it also look like Russia? I mean, gosh, I'm going to sound like a
tinfoil. Yeah, I know. This is hard.
I'm going to sound like a tinfoil hat wearer, but could it be the NSA testing American internet infrastructure? I don't know.
So maybe it could. On the internet, it's pretty easy to hide the origins of attacks. You could pretend to come from somewhere else. And depending on how much you see, that subterfuge is more or less effective. So there are a lot of attacks that come from China that aren't China because everyone knows attacks come from China. That's a little harder to do with these distributed denial of service attacks because they are so big. So it's not that likely that the origin that it looks like isn't the origin it is, but it is possible. Could the NSA be doing this? I'm not going to say no, but it does get a little tinfoil hatty, I agree. This is hard because, you know, you want to name names because we want to know who's doing it, but it isn't definitive, and this kind of false flagging, this hiding of origins, is possible. Mm-hmm. The NSA, because they spy on so much of the internet, will know where this comes from. They will see it and they will know. They're not going to tell us.
Okay. Well, so if you're then one of these high-level internet backbone companies that's experiencing these denial-of-service attacks, I mean, you write in your blog post that it's even things like testing the ability to manipulate internet addresses to see how long it takes the companies to respond. So how do you protect against these?
So these companies are already protecting themselves. None of these attacks have resulted in outages, so they've all been successfully defended against. And there are a lot of techniques out there. There are companies that have mitigation techniques that all of these companies purchase from, and this is not a new attack. They are used to it. They know how to deal with it. So far we've been successful in mitigating these attacks. But the attacker now knows kind of the limits of what the defenses are and knows how to take the sites down. Now, you can spend more money on defenses, and this is a question all the companies will have to answer. That is it worth defending themselves? And if you think about it, we all make these choices, right? We defend our homes, our businesses against criminals. We actually don't defend them against war, right? If war happens, that's kind of above our pay grade, and we assume someone else is going to take care of it.
Yeah.
And maybe the companies will make those same decisions here. If in fact, you know, the unthinkable happens and the U.S. and China are at war that involves bombs and troops and, you know, all the things you see in war movies, that someone else will handle protecting the internet and it's not going to be these companies' responsibility anymore.
Well, so do we have federal level readiness then for a kind of attack like this?
In a lot of ways, we don't. And that's interesting. I mean, I'm now a fellow at the Kennedy School at Harvard University, and there's a whole cyber program looking at the military and cyberspace. And we're getting there. The problem we have, and if it's a problem or a good thing, is that these are private infrastructures, that the ability of the U.S. military to intervene in corporate networks and corporate security is limited. And we like that. We don't want the military running our power grid, our internet, our airplanes, like would happen in other countries. I mean, thinking of China, for example. Mm-hmm. So we want that separation.
Right. Well, you close your blog post by saying this is happening, these denial of service attacks on high-level internet companies, and people should know. Is that your way of sounding the alarm, saying that, you know, that it's likely that at some time in the future we could see a takedown of the internet? And what would the implications be?
Yeah, I don't think it's likely. I really don't. I mean, I really think these are preps for war, and I just don't think the large-scale wars that we saw in the mid-20th century are likely in the 21st century. I just see too much intermingling of economies and societies and peoples. But I did want people to know, and the fact that no one's talking about it, and these companies all talk to me under anonymity, and agreed that I could publish anonymously, I felt like it was important to publish. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've heard from two other companies that said, yes, we're seeing this too. I'm urging them all to publish, to use their names, and we'll see if we'll get more actual data.
Bruce Schneier, I have to say, you are sounding much more confident than I feel.
I try.
Well, Bruce Schneier is a security technologist and a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He also writes the popular blog Schneier on Security, and we've got a link to his blog post at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The Old Farmer's Almanac is celebrating its 225th birthday with a special edition. It's the oldest continuously published periodical in North America. And joining us now is Janice Stillman, who is the 13th editor in the Almanac's history. Janice, welcome.
It's great to be with you. Thank you very much.
And only the 13th over all of those years?
Well, you know, the funny thing about that is Robert B. Thomas founded the Old Farmer's Almanac in 1792 when George Washington was president. And in that same 225 years, there have been 44 U.S. presidents, but only 13 editors of the Old Farmer's Almanac. So
it's a job you want to keep for a long time, I guess. Well, tell us, for people who don't know, what is the Farmer's Almanac?
Well, it's the Old Farmer's Almanac because there have always been Farmer's Almanacs. It's a genre like sports and news and fashion and whatever. And folks have used Farmer's Almanacs for as long as they've been gardening and raising animals. But the Old Farmer's Almanac is a true calendar of the heavens, which means you have the predictions for all of the astronomical events for every day throughout the year. And from the calendar flows all the rest of the content. The weather, certainly. The gardening, because there you go, you get the seasons. Then you've got recipes to do things with what you grow from. You've got folklore, which so much applies often to what you grow, herbs as well as, you know, vegetables and different fruits and things. And it just goes on from there. But that's the heart and soul of the Old Farmer's Almanac.
And let's talk about the weather, because that's something a lot of people care about. As we look forward to the winter of 2016-2017, what are you expecting?
It's going to be a relatively mild winter in most of the country. In fact, through the whole central part of the country, it's going to be mild and dry. Some snow, we usually get snow, but above normal temperatures, below normal precipitation. The West Coast will be cold and dry for the most part. That's California, where they need the water most.
Yeah.
The snow and moisture is going to fall up in the Northwest. And then mostly all across the border along Canada is where you're going to see the coldest temperatures and the snow. And there will be some snow down through the Appalachians as well. But that's really about it. You know, snow where you expect snow, but a lot less than you used to.
And one of the highlights of 2017 is the first total solar eclipse over the U.S. mainland in nearly 40 years.
Yes, make plans now. That's August 21st next summer.
Okay.
It's a Monday, so take a long weekend. You have to travel a little bit to get down in the best part of it, but you want to position yourself in the path of the eclipse. It's going to be from Oregon around Portland to around Columbia, South Carolina. And it's the weird effects that happen in the path of the eclipse, like the shadows that are created, the eclipse wind that occurs in the moment before and the moment after it happens. So I've talked to some towns along the line across the country, in the Midwest, for example, and they said they're already planning events for anybody who comes to their town. This was in Missouri, but there's, you know, 101 and more places you could go to be in the path of it. It's really a once-in-a-lifetime event.
But you can't tell me if it's going to be cloudy on that day.
You can check the weather forecast. We're traditionally 80% accurate. So, you know, take your best shot.
Well, yeah, how do you know what the weather is going to be so many months in advance?
We use three scientific disciplines. We use solar science, which is the study of the activity on the sun, in particular the sunspots, but there's other solar activity. We use climatology, which means that we look back in time to see how the solar activity corresponds to the climate and weather here on Earth. And we use meteorology, which is the water temperatures, the ocean, that is, the ocean temperatures, the land temperatures, the jet stream, and things like that. But I should tell you that anybody who knows anything about sunspots, now, we didn't invent this, and we're not the only ones who follow the science. Solar science is very common. This is, we're currently in one of the lowest cycles in more than 100 years, and historically, when that has happened in the past, there have been many years of well below normal cold temperatures. Look it up.
Hmm.
We're not saying that that's absolutely going to happen. Currently, we're thinking that the cold influence of the sun may be mitigated for a while by greenhouse gases. But a few years from now, maybe even a few decades, something could happen.
How much has the Almanac changed over the many decades and even centuries that it's been in publication?
The content has changed. There are more pages. There were 46 pages in the first edition. There are color pages now, many more of those. There are many more articles. You know, we like to think certainly it's national. When it first started, it was just a regional New England publication. But we like to think that it is really the same publication, but suited to everybody out there. And of course, Robert B. Thomas back in 1792 did not have the internet and e-reading devices like we have today. For virtually anything that you use, you can get an old farmer's almanac.
And the hole punched into the left-hand corner is for what?
The hole is to hang the almanac. It's to hang it on a string in the kitchen, in the shed, yes, in the outhouse, and folks still use those. I should say, not to give too much away, but our astrologer still uses an outhouse up in New Hampshire. God bless her. But that's what the hole is for. You know, in the late 90s, before I started at the old Farmer's Almanac, they did a survey and asked the readership, you know, what do you think about the hole? It's costing us like $47,000. We're talking nearly 3 million copies are getting holes punched in them. And they said, we're thinking about, you know, stopping doing that. And people said, never stop making the hole in the almanac. It wouldn't be the same. And each page is designed so that the hole doesn't interfere with the content.
It would have to be, I guess.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, people can get sloppy. We don't get sloppy.
Janice Stillman, editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac and the new 225th birthday edition is out now. Janice, thank you.
Thank you very much. And you know, when, as the winter comes, remember that no matter what the weather is, the only perfect climate is in bed.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.